Hi, welcome to Investment Essentials. I'm Al Juhal, tips editor of the magazine. I'm joined by my colleague, Mark Robinson.
And a little bit later, we'll be hearing from Joe Brownfreud, who's the chief executive of Asset Value Investors, and Nick Kerridge, co-head of Schroder's Global Value Team. Algie, what is Investment Essentials, and what was the dynamic behind the piece?
Well, Investment Essentials is, I like to think of it as kind of stock analysis meets desert island discs.
Okay.
Finding out what stock picking metrics certain top UK investors find most useful doing their jobs. So I've spoken to three of them. Two of them we'll be hearing from, and I've found out what they use to find value stocks.
The cyclically adjusted PE.
Discounts to net asset value.
Profits turning into cash.
The returns of the NAV.
A net debt EBITDA, or net debt profits.
EV to EBITDA, or the dividend yield.
Indebtedness.
Okay, this goes back to it's an age-old philosophy of value investing now, which started in the US in the 1930s, I believe, in the wake of the Great Depression.
Yeah, I mean, and also it's evolved a lot. But also there's the question of, what the heck is value? Because surely whenever we're trying to buy stocks, we want value there. Even if there's growth, we want to value that growth, and we want to have growth which is worth more than we're paying for it. This is what Nick Kerridge had to say about his style of value investing.
Value as an investment style has been around for decades and decades and decades. When you hear fund managers talk about value, they tend to kind of mean their perception of whether or not there's upside in shares. But when we talk, so-called valuation, but when we talk about value investing, we're speaking about a very specific part of the investment universe, a very explicit style. And it's basically continuously focusing your efforts on the cheapest 10 or 20% of the market. And you can filter that cheapest 10 or 20% any way you like. You know, it might be just a common PE or a price to book or a dividend yield, something very basic, but you are basically filtering the entire market and then looking at the cheapest part of it. And that's what you use to find the ideas. One of the things that's very interesting about cyclically adjusted valuations, in fact, this is true of all valuations really over time, but in the market today, we would perceive certain companies and industries as demonstrably being better than others. Your tobaccos are clearly better businesses than banks, or Unilever and consumer staples are clearly better businesses than mining companies. But whilst that's a statement that sounds like it's a truism, the truth is, if you look over long enough periods of time, that's not true. The companies that are perceived as high quality change and evolve over time. So though it's hard to remember, if you went back to 2005-06, banks were perceived as some of the best businesses that you could possibly invest in. If you went back to the late 1990s, tobaccos were perceived as businesses that killed their own customers. Most people consider that a bit of a business flaw. So this perception of quality is one that, whilst it always seems like this is the way it always is, it actually changes radically over time. So we're not very keen to compare industries with their own so-called industry valuations, because we don't think that those are very consistent over time. So we do it in absolute terms, and we simply look at the ones that are cheaper. And I think that gives us a more level-headed, more consistent framework for picking better companies over time, rather than relying on, for example, you were to buy an investment where it looked cheap versus valuations that have been quite expensive for the last few years, but it turned out those valuations were unjustified and that cheapness wasn't really very cheap.
Well, Benjamin Graham, I believe, who is often associated with the commencement of value investing, talked about the intrinsic value of companies.
Yeah.
What did he mean by that?
Often it's to do with the assets the company has and paying a discount for them, which Joe's very keen on. This is what he had to say on the subject.
Well, to us, value is reflected in companies trading at discounts to net asset value. So value as a style means different things to different types of managers. To us, what we're looking for is companies that own assets. Those assets could be other businesses, other equities that may be listed, or companies that are unlisted. But essentially, to us, value investing really means finding companies that trade at discounts to net asset value. So essentially what we're saying is we like to buy companies that own a pound of assets for a lot less than that pound. So if you think about a company that owns a variety of different businesses, each of those businesses can be sold, can be independently realized, and the sum of that realizable value is far more than the current share price. And that, to us, is the starting point for identifying what value is.
There are other ways to value intrinsic value for companies which don't have hard, tangible assets, using things like the earning power of a company. And then also there are ways of trying to bring in the idea that some companies can generate above average returns or returns above their cost of capital consistently whilst they grow. So that can be valued in too, that future earnings stream. So it's a plethora of things, really, which fit into this value camp.
Does that also feed into something like discounted cash flow analysis?
Most value investors are very sceptical about that because, I mean, there's so many assumptions in any discounted cash flow analysis. If there's something very tangible...
being chief amongst them.
What the heck are we discounting? What are we using as our discount rate?
Yeah.
And the investors I've talked to, and also just... from an intuitive level, really, when we're talking about value, we're probably just talking about really cheap stocks. Nick Kirridge.
A lot of the best investment philosophies, I believe, can be boiled down into very, very simple terms. The more complicated something sounds, the more clever someone tries to sound, you know, more often than not, those kinds of philosophies tend to get themselves into trouble. So my perspective is always it should be made very, very simple. So at its core, my job is simply trying to balance off the rewards that might be made from an investment versus the risks I'm taking, and doing that as objectively as possible without turning myself into an emotional wreck, okay? So I like metrics that try and give me a clue to identify both those potential rewards and those potential risks.
This was the basis of Benjamin Graham's philosophy, or at least the reason that he took it up when he did, because after the major sell-off in markets, presumably there was any number of undervalued stocks, you know, trading well below their net asset value. I mean, it would have been fairly straightforward to pick these up then.
Well, yeah, of course, they're the famous net nets, which were associated with Graham, which were where the readily realizable net asset value was worth a lot more than the share price. I mean, you don't get those really now, but
and of course, you look at the example of the asset strippers during the 1980s; they were doing much the same thing.
Well, yeah, they weren't, but they were probably doing more of what British Empire does in terms of looking deeper, having a deeper analysis of what's actually on the books. Joe Brownfreund.
To us, net asset value really means the realisable value of those businesses today, which means that we have to value each of the underlying holdings. So if you take, an investment trust, for example, it's fairly simple. It's certainly an investment trust that owns listed assets. It's very simple. It would be the realizable value of those listed stakes. When you look at an investment trust that owns private equity assets or an investment holding company that has private assets, we carry out a valuation of each of the private businesses. And that's done by reference to listed peers and analysis of the various metrics, typically EV to EBITDA or price earnings multiples, and see how those compare to listed peers.
Does that also feed into when you look at funds that deal in special situations as well? I mean, very often if a company is going through a particularly dire trading period, or there's external issues or internal ones that have affected performance, sometimes it's easy to overlook the actual value, the fixed asset value of a company.
Yeah, and also the fixed assets, of course, can be a guide to the future potential of the company in question. And a lot of investors look at an economic cycle, and try and look over that to get a fairer assessment of what value is on offer, because they expect the earnings to rebound after they've fallen for a while. They'll come back. Nick Kirridge.
So the first, and for anyone who's ever read our blog on the value perspective, they'll have seen this a lot, is the CAPE. The cyclically adjusted PE. There are many other names for this. You may have heard Shiller PE or 10-year average PE. They all mean the same thing. They effectively mean taking today's share price and dividing it by the average profits of the last 10 years, the average earnings per share of the last 10 years. Now, why would you do that? Well, you do that because profits in any one year can frequently swing around. We've seen that through the last 5-10 years. Many businesses are very cyclical. Their profits go up, their profits go down, their margins go up, their margins go down. And yet many of those businesses have been around for decades. And they may be around for decades to come. So valuing them off any 1 year's worth of profits could be a very churlish thing to do. And with typical valuation metrics, a normal PE, what will happen is just as the profits go to zero, the PE looks like it goes to a very high number because you divide very small profits into a share price and suddenly the valuation looks very expensive. But that's not the truth. The truth is that the share price tends to fall on that. And if you divided the share price by the average profits of the last 10 years, it would reveal a business that is very cyclical, but is very, very attractive. So we like to look at that because it strips out the machinations of the economic cycle. And goodness knows, the economic cycle has had its machinations the last 10 years. So by doing that, it makes a more consistent way to look at companies. There could be lots of reasons that those average 10 years aren't a good guide. The last 10 years aren't a good guide to the future. And I can hear people talking about, but what about newspaper stocks, Nick, or, you know, other companies where there's been a structural change? And that's right, there are. So you have to be quite careful using this in isolation. But on average, the last 10 years do tend to be a very good guide to the future for most companies. It's a very powerful way to think about valuation.
Algy, if you were speaking to one of our readers who've never given much thought to investing from this perspective, what are the baseline sort of tips that you would give? Where should they be looking and where should they start?
But one of the things which investors have to be very aware of when trying to adopt a value style is value traps. And often the difference between a great value play and a value trap, which is basically a cheap company, which continues to get cheaper until eventually things get so bad that it looks expensive at any price.
Yes.
And you've got your head in your hands. Yeah. But there's not much difference between them. You know, they will look very similar. That's why the value share is great value, because it looks so bad. It looks like it could be the value trap share.
Joe Brownfreund. There are probably hundreds, if not thousands, of companies that trade at some sort of discount to the theoretical asset value. Now, very often, those kind of discounts are a warning sign of a value trap. And the discount exists for a reason. The underlying assets may be poor quality. The management of those businesses may have weak corporate governance. They could be invested in an industry that's cyclical and due a downturn. So the discount would be a warning sign to stay away.
Well, it sounds as well that they're going to have to do a little bit of legwork through the P&L and balance sheet and the cash flow statement as well.
Well, I mean, there's always legwork in investment if you want to maximise your chances of doing well. But what the investment essentials piece in the magazine has are a number of ways to identify promising opportunities. Nick Kirridge.
You can't talk about value investing without talking about value traps. They're two sides of the same coin. The problem is that value trap is not it's not a well-defined term like profits or free cash flow or CAPE. It means many things to many people. So the average person on the street, if they heard the word value trap, would think business that was going nowhere. So an HMV, for example, a structurally challenged business. I tend to think about value traps as businesses which, it doesn't really matter how hard they swim, they're on a declining elevator. There is some structural impediment to them making returns. It could be an HMV, that's probably a reasonable example. Or it might be a business that was very constrained by regulation. Or the structure of the industry, airlines struggle very much to make returns on capital. So you have to kind of try and get behind that. But what I would say is that many people just think value trap is a company which takes a long time for the share price to go up. And that's just being patient. So, you know, we measure patience in years, not in quarters or in months. And that's a very different perspective to many. You have to be quite careful about this because you sometimes can use the term just value trap to simply justify giving up on an investment. And that, of course, is an incredibly poor thing to do if it's just for emotional reasons. I've just given up. So you've got to make sure you understand what that term means, but then stick with it, obviously, and pay attention to it.
I think one of the points that you've made to me is that when you're looking at value investing, many people might think, all right, we've identified the company, right, and we can make returns almost immediately. But really, you're looking at it's a long-term play, value investing.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it's to do with waiting. And I mean, the interesting thing...
You need patience.
Yeah, and the interesting thing talking to value investors is that very few of them really are interested in when the value is going to be realized. And generally, you know, over the long term, over 50 years, values massively outperformed growth and a world index in general. But it takes a lot of psychological fortitude to rough it out through those inevitable periods when value investing will underperform and go on to bag those great long-term returns. When we're talking about value stocks and cheap stocks and stocks where things are going wrong, we know from all the work that these people have done in behavioural finance, that goes completely against the grain. Joe Brownfreund.
I think that value investors have to have conviction in what they do, because at times, in fairness, probably the same for most styles of investment, but at times the market will test you and the market will tell you that you're wrong and you're making a mistake. And, you know, I think it's important to stick to your convictions, to stick to your framework of investing, certainly one that's been tried and tested over time, and to not get carried away by what others are doing and just to focus on what we believe to be the right thing. It's difficult and it's unpleasant, but I think the important thing is to be aware that it is going to happen. And, you know, when it happens, just to ensure that you have a framework that you follow, and the framework should give, and it certainly in my case, has given me conviction that ultimately, if we do the right thing when it comes to our style of investing and the work that we put into our analysis, ultimately the market will prove us right. There's undoubtedly career risk, and investors may leave us, and our clients may put us under pressure and may make us uncomfortable. But, you know, that's the stall we've set out for ourselves. And I think the far more dangerous thing to do is to try and be different things to all men and try and change our style, because inevitably you'll change at the wrong point in time.
You have to either have a process which you really believe in, which I think these investors do, or you just have to be a bit crazy to be a value investor. Nick Kirridge.
I think we're probably all wired totally the wrong way around, to be honest with you. I'm one of those people who, you know, I tend to get excited when I see share prices falling, because I feel like that, you know, the kind of falling where things are falling very, very quickly, that tends to be emotional and therefore irrational to my thinking. Not always. Sometimes there's a good reason that's happening. But if you're a long-term investor, and we tend to be, the nature of being a value investor is you've got to be taking a five-year view, because things are obviously tough, troubled, and you don't know whether or not they might be tough or troubled for another year, another 2 years before they recover. And so you're taking a long-term horizon. But if you do that, you tend to see these things as a great opportunity. And some of the great investment returns that you've seen in the last 10 years have come from moments of great darkness, you know, buying house building stocks in 2009 when everyone thought the world was ending, or high street retail companies in 2008. It is at those points where nobody's holding your hand. It is difficult. That's why we maintain that diversification. But the rewards are phenomenal if you can maintain that psychological grip on what's going on and simply be, you know, pretty hard-headed.
Well, there we have it. Patience and discipline. That's all you need.
Thank you to the producers of this show, Graham Davies and Alex Newman. And if you've enjoyed it, please do leave a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.